Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, here we are. Just a warning to everyone, this is about as good as it gets. I was thinking about this morning, we have a community that's very diligent, we get along with each other, we all have kutis, there are no deer flies. We have good financial support. A couple of arahants would be nice, but you don't want to be greedy. But really, the perception was, and like I must admit, with Peter here, it's a kind of great relief off my mind about projects. I'm just feeling very light today. I don't have to think about that. So for me, it was a perception that this is a peak experience. So that when something happens, the deer fly come back when it's hot, when we have disagreements, I get sick, banks fail, whatever it is, then the perception will be things have fallen apart. So perceptions are conditioned by causes and conditions, and they perceptions are created in the mind through these kinds of things. So, but perceptions are unreliable. So rather than the percent, like that's why Ajahn Smith is very lovely the way he'll say, "Hare Dhamma, this is a peak experience." Rather than, "Oh, this is great, the monastery is really going well." Because that's a dangerous perception, because you can think it's always going to be that way, and then when it changes, then there's praise and there's blame usually, and worry and all. But when you see it's just natural for it to change, then you endure the difficult times if they come. Anyway, it's interesting. It's the old mind. makes me look like a scholar. A big book like that. This is the Anguttara. This morning I was just saying that the idea that last few mornings you come to conclusions rather than using the Dhamma as a kind of alive, reflective vehicle. This is and we do come to conclusions for sure, but I guess what I was pointing to was the danger of thinking you understand, and you might intellectually, but actually the insight's not there. That's probably worse than thinking you don't understand, because you can get this kind of conceit. So I had that. We were discussing this morning some of, I was discussing my earlier readings in Buddhism, and I read what for me was a very complicated analysis of dependent origination, and it was quite difficult to get my head around. It's the first entry into Buddhism, and I kind of broke the code, as it were. I thought I understood it, and felt quite proud of myself. But I could also see the conceit coming up, that I was the kind of in the know, and the rest of these plebs didn't know anything. You know, that kind of arrogance. But all it really was, I mean, it was a good intellectual exercise, and it helped me. But it wasn't the same as insight. It wasn't the same at all. In fact, it was. I could see the danger of it. It's a kind of conceit that I knew something. But suffering soon brought me back down to earth. I realized there is much work to do. So, you've all read the Kalama Sutta. I'm sure. It's very primal, primary sutta. I don't know what they call it. And in that, the Buddha lists some of the ways that we get caught up into conclusions which are actually not that insightful. So, shall I read from? So the Kalamas approach the Buddha and they say, Bhante, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta. They explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride and denounce the doctrines of others. But then, some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride and denounce the doctrines of others. We are perplexed and in doubt, Bhante, as to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood. And the Buddha, it is fitting for you to be perplexed, Kalamas, fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Come, Kalamas, do not go by, and here's the refrain, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our guru. So that covers a lot of ways that society or culture takes on popular notions that people read. I was talking with Curtis about that memory retrieval things that went on like 10, 20 years ago where kids would retrieve memories and then people would be of abuse and then people would be convicted for abuse, but they actually had no evidence. And then the psychologists were sued and so on. They saw, how faulty memory was, and certainly their abuse existed, but a lot of the memories apparently had been created into the kids' minds. And I remember it was in Stokes Valley in Wellington. At the time, this was quite a hot topic. And there was a guy at the base of the street, and he had been convicted of child abuse, and he swore up and down that he hadn't done it. And I knew the guy. I kind of believed him. One never knows. Apparently abusers always do that. But he had just been convicted on hearsay, on something like that. And I remember that was quite a popular notion around in culture, that kind of memory retrieval. And then I remember, I was just thinking back to all the fads that have gone through monasteries. There was Primal Scream, that was one, where somehow you were brought to some cathartic memory in your childhood, even sometimes in the birth canal or something like that, I can't remember. And you had this primal scream and somehow you were liberated from all these obstructions. And when that was going on, I was in India, I was a layman. And there was a guy called Eight Finger Eddie, who was an American guru in Goa. And all kinds of people were coming to him, and he was doing this primal scream until two women jumped down a well. I don't think they died, they broke their legs or something. Anyway, you get all kinds of, all kinds of fads go through our culture, through the popular Buddhism is, or psychology fads, or fads about child rearing. Some of the things that went on about childhood, and so on and so forth. So these are kind of, it's a nice list to contemplate. Do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our guru. Now, that has been taken out of context in popular Buddhism as an excuse to follow your own views and opinions. And so the sutta has been, you find that misquoted, because it doesn't include the rest of the sutta. And that's what Curtis and I had a nice discussion in the car back from Toronto, and he was saying that, he said that's probably one of the, what he felt the limitations of humanism were. That I've never studied what the kind of philosophical ground of humanism is, but he said its underpinning is that as long as you don't hurt anyone, your choice of, the best choice for your own happiness is to follow your kind of preferences of what makes you happy. That's what he said. Well, that would not be true in Buddhism, because your own preferences might be quite deluded. But when kalamas, you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if accepted are and undertaken, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. So it's not so much an intellectual conclusion, but you just know these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise. And so the sutta basically is saying that there's like two criteria for judging what the result of your life is, what the direction of your life is. One is your own, the results of your own practice, your own life, your own action, speech, and counsel from the wise. So these two. What do you think, kalamas, when greed arises in a person, is it for his welfare or his harm? For his harm, Bhante. Kalamas, a greedy person overcome by greed, with mind obsessed by it, destroys life, takes what is not given, transgresses with another's wife, and speaks falsehood, and he encourages others to do likewise. Will that lead to his harm and suffering for a long time? Yes, Bhante. So he goes through the five precepts. So when greed arises in a person, is this for his welfare or his harm? So just to have a kind of sense of enough awareness that even if you follow greed, it doesn't actually lead to wholesome states of mind or not. Does it lead to regret or remorse, or does it lead to peace? And then that's a conclusion you come to as an existential experience. What do you think, kalamas? When hatred arises in a person, is it for the welfare, for his welfare or his harm? For his harm, Bhante. Kalamas, a person who is full of hate, overcome by hatred, with mind obsessed by it, destroys life, etc., and he encourages others to do likewise. Will that lead to his harm and suffering for a long time? Yes, Bhante. So again, when hatred arises, it might not lead us to break precepts, but it is the result of my action and speech. When hatred's there, is it skillful or unskillful? So you see for yourself. So there's an arising of hiriyotapa and a kind of responsibility around hateful states of mind. What do you think, Kalamas, when delusion arises in a person, is it for his welfare or for his harm? For his harm, Bhante, Kalamas, a person who is deluded, overcome by delusion, with a mind obsessed by it, destroys life and encourages others to do likewise. Will that lead to his harm and suffering for a long time? Yes, Bhante. So all the forms of ego delusion that we suffer from. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Unwholesome, Bhante. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameworthy, Bhante. Censured or praised by the wise? Censured by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken, do they lead to harm and suffering or not? Or how do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, these things lead to harm and suffering, so we take it. And you see, that this comes from a culture where elders are respected. You see, if a culture has, you know, if teachers aren't respected, or why is there no wise beings, and it's everyone's opinion, and whatever, you know, it's not like there's someone who's a better, it's, well, whatever you think is fine. And that's a very impoverished society when there are no wise beings who are listened to, everyone's opinion is the same. Or when one doesn't have a sense of blameworthiness, or they have one of the words that we use the strongest, like in Thailand, to censure if we're critical of a monk's behavior. The strongest word you usually find is that he is shameless. Interesting way, you know, not that he's a complete deadbeat, but rather that he's shameless. There's no sense of hiriyota. Knowing what is blameworthy or what is blameless is different than self-hatred, isn't it? It's not. Self-hatred isn't that. It's just knowing the course of action and the results. Censured or praised by the wise, censured by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken, do they lead to harm and suffering or not? Or how do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, these things lead to harm and suffering. And that's what we're watching. And that's where our conclusions come from, don't we? The way we think, act. If we pick these things up, are they skillful or unskillful? Thus, Kalamas, when we said, come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, etc., but when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. It is because of this that this was said. So there's the idea of abandoning the unskillful. Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our guru. But when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should live in accordance with them. So when it says, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage, by collection of scriptures, it doesn't mean that one does not refer to those as one's direction. It simply means one doesn't leave it just there. One goes deeper than that. What do you think, Kalamas? When non-greed arises in a person, is it for his welfare or for his harm? For his welfare, Bhante, Kalamas, a person without greed, not overcome by greed, his mind not obsessed by it, does not destroy life, take what is not given, transgress with another's wife, or speak falsehood, nor does he encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to his welfare and happiness for a long time? Yes, Bhante. Now it's interesting how they use these, like it's non-greed, how they use the absence of form quite often. And to recognize that in your mind, when your mind is in a state of non-greed, recognize how peaceful that is. Rather than thinking, you know, greed, I must kind of give everything up and I mustn't have anything, a kind of negation of greed, but rather notice how non-greed, what's that like? Your mind isn't craving something or, you know, wanting something. What does non-greed feel like? I think that's very, sometimes we don't notice that. We just notice when greed's there. And so we're critical of the greed or we follow it or whatever, but when it's not there, non-greed. Like right now, maybe your needs are okay, you don't want to get out of here. Non-greed, what does that feel like? To recognize that. What do you think, Kalamas? When non-hatred arises in a person, is it for his welfare or his harm? For his welfare, Bhante, Kalamas, a person who is without hate, not overcome by hatred, his mind not obsessed by it, does not destroy life, etc., nor does he encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to his welfare and happiness for a long time? Yes, Bhante. And so the same thing, like notice the mind which isn't like caught by self-criticism, judgment, complaining, all the different ways of aversion that might arise. What's the mind when it's not there, when it's not doing that? And notice how skillful speech can be when it's not there. Notice how skillful action can be when it's not there. And the thoughts too, the whole mental realms. So noticing non-hatred, rather than, again, just always having to think, oh, I should have compassion if I have hatred. Those are helpful, I mean, obviously important, but to actually notice non-hate. And what do you think, Kalamas, when non-delusion arises in a person, is it for his welfare or his harm? For his welfare, Bhante, Kalamas, a person who is undeluded, not overcome by delusion, his mind not obsessed by it, does not destroy life, etc., nor does he encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to his welfare and happiness for a long time? Yes, Bhante. So like non-delusion, when the mind isn't producing a lot of self-view, isn't churning up a lot of me and you and time, be it through worry or anger, whatever, when the mind isn't churning up a lot of ego thoughts, ego states, when the mind has a sense of emptiness of self, notice that, it's there. Just keep referring to that, and then notice how clear the decisions are, how clear speech is, how clear the thinking mind is. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Wholesome, Bhante. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameless, Bhante. Censured or praised by the wise? Praised by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken, do they lead to welfare and happiness or not? Or how do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, these things lead to welfare and happiness. So we take it. So accepted and undertaken, like to undertake. To undertake speech from non-hatred, from non-criticism, from non-aversion. Very good result, isn't it? But to pick up speech from aversion, criticism, complaining, gives a very bad result. And that's really what our practice is deepened by. We just see these results are not good, or these results are good. And that's beyond conjecture. And it's not like a conclusion, just intellectual conclusion. Thus, Kalamas, when we said, come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, but when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things have accepted and undertaken lead to welfare and happiness, then you should live in accordance with them. It is because of this that this was said. Then, Kalamas, that noble disciple who is thus devoid of longing, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, ever mindful. So you have these very simple lists, but they're, you know, very, very profound. And sometimes you read these things over and you've seen that list before and you skip it over, you want to get to the juicy bit or whatever. Or you know, they're common words too, so sometimes we just, because we understand them, we don't sometimes dwell on them enough. just kind of dwell on a word, say, oh, what's that word like? What's that like in the mind? Because we tend to, you know, we were trained to read for content. So we're trained to read quickly and to get the idea so that we can get to the next chapter and so on and so forth. And many of us just read the concluding chapter. I do that quite often. I read the opening chapter, get the idea. Or no, read the last page maybe of each chapter. You get most of the book that way. That's the way I used to study in university, unfortunately. But this is a different kind of reading. So just a list like this, then Kalamas, that noble disciple who is thus devoid of longing. You just take that word, devoid of longing, and you kind of just kind of mull that one over like a good camembert. You mull it over, and then devoid of longing. Hold that in the mind for a while, then sure enough, through the day, longing will become apparent because you've given the contemplative mind some kind of mirroring or food to contemplate. So devoid of longing, and then maybe you'll notice some kind of longing going on in the mind, and you say, "Oh, what would devoid of longing feel like?" If you contemplate longing, devoid of ill will, unconfused. Clearly comprehending. You can mull that one over. Ever mindful. And then, dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with altruistic joy. I would prefer goodwill to loving kindness. I prefer that translation much more. Goodwill to me is something. Anyway, it's metta is the word. But goodwill, you think, if you just think about like just that word, goodwill. Goodwill. And then someone gets up your nose. You know, you get up your nose, they say something which twists your head a bit or whatever, or criticize what you've done, and then you're fine, you're back in your kutti, and then the memory comes up of that unpleasant encounter. And what arises with that is just a tinge, maybe, of revenge. You know, it's not a total death plot, but just enough to think, I'll get them, or just a kind of unpleasant thing in the mind. And then, this is not goodwill. And then with someone else who's been complimentary to you or you get along with, and you think of them, you think, yeah, I hope he's doing all right in his practice, that kind of thing. So you bring attention to those, like goodwill and ill will towards yourself. Very important, ill will towards yourself. So when you find maybe you're very forgiving to other people. Someone says something or makes a mistake, yeah, don't worry about it, it's all right, fine. But then you're really hypercritical to yourself. Just notice that, oh, this is goodwill, forgiveness to this character. But the guy that's sitting here, he gets slayed like he's some kind of criminal. They're kind of just noticing that goodwill. There's goodwill. So these words have again, I think they have great power if they're used in a contemplative way. Mind imbued with compassion. With a mind imbued with altruistic joy. I was reading Tanjef's rendition of this, and for altruistic joy he uses appreciation. I think I like that better too. You know, just appreciation of someone's goodness, or just a, like today I was really appreciating being here because everything's going well. You wait, we're done. It will change. But just, yeah, what is appreciation? Around beauty or people's goodness. What is that? What is that state of mind? Appreciation of one's own, like keeping precepts and being generally quite diligent. Appreciation of that, not as self-inflating ego. I know we don't find much of that in our sangha that much, but just appreciation for the goodness of what you do. You know, that you do keep precepts, that you do. You know, you try to help out and things like that. It seems very ordinary. just appreciation. What is that mudita? What is that quality that the Buddha asked us to develop? With the mind imbued with equanimity. Ooh, that's a tough one. That's the biggie, isn't it? If the mind remains smooth and peaceful through all the trials and tribulations of community life, etc. And with the mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second quarter, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all is to himself. He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. Beautiful. You know, and that's got to be some of the most beautiful literature that humans have ever penned, if you think about it. I mean, that's really fabulous. It really is. I mean, what a fabulous teaching. It's just, I mean, no one's excluded from this. We're all in it. So, likewise the second quarter, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself and herself, Marian. This is all recorded, they'll know. But then that's important, isn't it? Thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without enmity, without ill will. And those are really good, you know, vast and measureless. Those are good words to see how they affect you, how they might work. This noble disciple, Kalamas, whose mind is in this way without enmity, without ill will, undefiled and pure, has won four assurances in this very life. The first, so the Kalamas were probably asking questions about rebirth, as they still do today. Is there rebirth? How does rebirth work? The first assurance he has won is this: if there is another world, and if there is the fruit and result of good and bad deeds, it is possible that with the breakup of the body after death, I will be reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world. The second assurance he has won is this: if there is no other world, and there is no fruit and result of good and bad deeds, still, right here, in this very life, I maintain myself in happiness, without enmity and ill will, free of trouble. The third assurance he has won is this: suppose evil comes to one who does evil, then, when I have no evil intentions toward anyone, how can suffering afflict me, since I do no evil deed? The fourth assurance he has won is this: suppose all evil does not come to one who does evil, then right here I see myself purified in both respects. This noble disciple, Kalamas, whose mind is in this way, without enmity, without ill will, undefiled and pure, has won these four assurances in this very life. So it is, blessed one, so it is, fortunate one. Oh, I like that one too, fortunate one. It kind of, you know, that's appreciation, that's mudita, isn't it? Fortunate one. This noble disciple whose mind is in this way without enmity, without ill will, undefiled and pure, has won four assurances in this very life. The first assurance he has won, etc., as above, down to the fourth assurance he has won is this: suppose evil does not befall the evildoer, then right here I see myself purified in both respects. This noble disciple Bhante, whose mind is in this way, without enmity, without ill will, undefiled and pure, has won these four assurances in this very life. Excellent Bhante, we go for refuge to the Blessed One, to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha Bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One consider us lay followers who, from today, have gone for refuge for life. Ewang. So, consider the whole, the life of contemplation, and consider the use of language as, don't just look at Buddhism as a kind of, you know, you kind of do some kind of concentration practices, and the rest of the time you're just making do, or you know, the real practice is when I'm on the cushion. Certainly, that's very important, but even if you meditate 4 hours a day, you still got 20 left. So you know, it's good to get used to make use of them. So to emphasize the ongoing power of contemplation, the power of good language, good words, insightful words to modify, to direct you, to like just to use like good words in your meditation. Everyone has insights. You have insights about your meditation. Just to develop like good language to coach yourself when you're meditating. Like maybe if you try too hard, a simple word like relax, just relax. You know, but done with insight, not just a sort of tyranny of you shouldn't relax. You know, it's more like we all get insight into the way we practice meditation or we live our lives, and then to keep making those insights alive again. You use language, don't you? We remind ourselves. So remind ourselves of what right effort is.
And that's
very personal. Each of us has a personal sense of. Some people will use Burmese language. Some people will use English language. But it's more than just it's the metaphors you develop for yourself or the imagery that you develop for yourself. It's very, very helpful. And that's quite creative, quite creative use of language. So the text and the teachers, that language is very, very helpful. So that we're not just believing or just leaving it in the scripture, that we take that lovely language and we constantly enliven it. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayam dhammakataya sadhu karam dadamase
sa